Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. I'm Alex West with...
Andrea Subisati.
Did you almost forget your name?
I was like, Mother! Alex West and Mother here. I am Mother.
Well...
AMA.
We've got Mother on the brain, and it's December 2018, and as it's the holiday season, we like to pick a film that has to do with togetherness, poignant religious times, I'd say.
Okay.
I feel like those kind of go hand in hand with our choices for this time of year for the last 6 years.
6 years.
6 years.
Jeepers.
Yep. So yeah, this one came about from you guys because Andrea and I both saw this film the end of last year. We both really responded to it so much so that we both mentioned it in our best of 2017 that we recorded in January 2018. And we got a lot of strong responses to this film. So we wanted to dedicate a whole episode to it.
Yeah. Why not?
And, you know, it's an interesting film. It's an interesting film to experience. It's an even more boggling film to really take apart. So that's what we're going to get into.
Yeah. I'm not sure entirely how I feel. I mean, I was on board with doing this episode just because the response was so strong. People have been mentioning it all year. When are you going to talk about it? Are you going to talk about it? I really want you to talk about it. And I've wanted to talk about it with you, because I feel like there's stuff to talk about. But at the same time, even launching into research for this, Aronofsky himself was like, you know, the allegories are pretty clear, but if you dig too deep, it unravels. Like, don't overthink it. And I think for once, this is a film that kind of hits me in that spot where I'm like, it was an experience. It was a very personal experience to me. I'm happy to discuss it the way faculty does, because I'm discussing it with you as a friend. But yeah, I'm eager to see what we can pull out of this film that's not too on the nose and that doesn't detract from what a beautiful experience this is.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're going to do this episode. We're going to figure out where that discussion lies and how it lies and how it makes us feel and then how it might make you guys feel. So without further ado, this is Darren Aronofsky's Mother.
We spend all our time here. I want to make a paradise.
She redid all of it. Every last detail. And she breathed life back into every room.
Are you happy?
I love you.
Please, come in. Hello.
Hello. He's a stranger. We're just gonna let him sleep in our house. Hello.
Hello.
Did you know he had a wife? He has pictures of you in his luggage.
What were you doing in their luggage?
Exclamation mark.
Mother!
Mother!
But it's an exclamation point, so it wouldn't be like, Mother!
What do you mean? What is that?
I don't know. Maybe it should go up at the end or go to, I don't know.
You know, we're joking about the exclamation mark. To me, I read that as an antithesis to the first and last lines of the film, which are, baby, Ooh. What do you think?
I think that's interesting.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Sweet. There's a start.
One day in the house that Mother and him are fixing up, a man comes by the house, and it is revealed the man is a huge fan of him's poetry, and that man is dying. Man is soon joined by his wife, Woman. Man and Woman accidentally break a crystal that him forbade them to touch. Man and Woman's sons join them, getting into a fight over their father's will, where one of them is killed. Visitors descend on the house to mourn the son's passing, causing chaos. Mother throws them out. Mother and him have a huge fight, and they wind up having passionate sex.
As you do.
Wow. And Mother becomes pregnant. Him becomes inspired to finish his newest work and releases it into the world, causing even larger crowds to descend on the house, tearing it apart through their obsession with him. Mother goes into labor and has a son, who the crowd proceeds to rip apart. Mother flees into the basement and blows up the house using the furnace gas, killing everyone. Him is seemingly unharmed and asks Mother for one last thing, her heart, and she gives it to him. He crumbles the heart, revealing a new crystal, causing the cycle of the film to repeat once again.
With a new woman.
With a new woman.
Yeah. God, that's almost hard to listen to. Just as an editor, the grammar.
Oh my God, writing it, it was everything in my body was like, nope, but here we are.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me how much of this biblical allegory, which in some respects is so obvious, it hits you over the head, but at the same time, it's a little bit murky. There's a couple of problems. There's a couple of tangents to unpack. Did that get you right away?
It got me by the time the two sons showed up.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's, I think, Cain and Abel. And obviously then it becomes Adam and Eve. And I had heard, basically what I first heard of the film was in 2017 when it played at TIFF that mm-hmm. September. And all I'd heard was this divisive rhetoric around the film. Mm-hmm. People were coming out that it was brilliant. People said it was fucking garbage and it was stupid and they hated it. Mm-hmm. So immediately that was something I really wanted to see because I personally kind of go back and forth on Aronofsky as a filmmaker.
Okay.
There's some of his films I really, really like and I think are really brilliant and hard to watch. Films like Requiem for a Dream, Black Swan. Like that.
Which we did an episode on.
And then there's some like The Fountain, which I find so stupid. Mm. So he's one of those filmmakers, I go either way with him, and I'm always kind of excited to see what he does. I think it was really interesting that his film prior to Mother was Noah, about Noah's Ark, which I have not seen.
Very contentious.
Yeah, and so then he's kind of gone on to make this other film. And and so what I'd heard on top of that before I saw it was that basically it's just one big metaphor.
Okay.
So I went into it kind of knowing it was going to be a bit of a, like, one-for-one meaning.
Okay. I got the Mother Earth metaphor pretty quick. I couldn't quite place him. Mm. The capital H in the credits, which is supposed to be the big giveaway, that didn't hit me. I was like, is he industry? Is he culture? Is he Enlightenment era? Who is he? Why is he a poet? You know, when I think of poetry, I think of that as like a really political art form in its time, which is now really, you know, pretty obsolete.
I know. It's
sorry,
like those
poets.
Those guys you meet on fucking Tinder who are like, I'm a poet, but I also work in a pizza shop.
Yeah. Like even the fact that he was like, oh, I need to be inspired. I need to be my muse and stuff like that. You're just kind of like, ah, man, poets are lame. And so Man and Woman, Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the Christ-like allegory of her son who is celebrated by the crowd until he is torn apart and literally consumed as opposed to symbolically consumed later. But before we get too into that, I mean, I think we should maybe just go over that Judeo-Christian origin story because my partner wasn't familiar with it at all. He knew that there was an Adam and he knew that there was an Eve. He didn't know the ins and outs, and so I don't expect anyone to have that hammered into them the way it was hammered into me throughout my entire childhood. So, as a very brief gloss over, the Judeo-Christian origin story appears in the book of Genesis at the start of the Old Testament. And the Old Testament of the Bible is considered a sacred source book for both Christianity and Judaism, BT Dubs. The Garden of Eden story that we're going to talk about is estimated to have been written about 500 BCE, some 2400 years ago. Now, in the first story of Genesis, God creates the heavens and the earth in a week, keeping one day to rest. In the second Genesis story, he creates the first man, Adam, and puts him in the Garden of Eden, which is essentially paradise, and he's supposed to be in charge of all the animals. You know, I think the biblical term is he has dominion of them. Eventually, God also creates him a mate, the first woman, Eve, from Adam's rib. The two of them have a blast in Eden, naked as jaybirds and free to do whatever they want, except they're forbidden to eat fruit from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Satan, in the form of a serpent, talks Eve into eating the fruit, who then convinces Adam to join in, because women, right? And in so doing, they lose their innocence, they become aware of good and evil, which gives them the agency to choose to live either a virtuous life or one of sin. They're banished from Eden, and they have to fend for themselves in the wilderness. Now, moving forward, their story goes on to, they have two sons called Cain and Abel. Cain was responsible for farming, while Abel looked after the livestock. When God showed preference for Abel's sacrifices, Cain got jealous and murdered his brother. He was subsequently banished to a life of wandering. And then we flash way forward to the Jesus mythology, where God decides to give humanity the gift of his son in flesh and blood. And what does humanity do? We celebrate him for a second, and then we destroy him, symbolically eating his flesh to consume his holiness to this very day, like I mentioned. So again, it's a story. Mm-hmm. It's a story that, as far as biblical stories go, I don't take a whole lot of, you know, sometimes the parables have this morality stream to it. I don't really know what this is saying to us other than woman is the root of all evil, which is definitely something that has carried through and problematized mm-hmm. Christianity throughout its existence. Anything else you glean from that story?
One of the things is, and I was not raised with religion. I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but both my parents are atheists or agnostic, depending on the day, frankly. And so am I, to be totally honest. But what I always thought about this mythology was that it's so clear-cut. Mm. It's so black and white. Mm-hmm. It's like, this happens, now you can be good or you can be bad. Mm-hmm. And this guy sacrificed more, or God liked him better, so now the other one's jealous. And it always just felt very, like, transactional. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's just the Bible stories that I assume kids in Bible school learn on Sundays, or whatever the hell you people did.
Yeah, on Sunday, my goodness. That, like, every single day, this mythology was again and again and again.
And I definitely became wise to it through my childhood. I think I had some, like, Bible books, maybe even, like, a Bible comic book or something.
Cute.
And I was just interested in it because it seemed like it was such a big part of culture and I just wasn't privy to it. Mm-hmm. And I thought there was going to be some deeper understanding to it. Like, oh, if I really bought into this or if I really understood it, it would really mean something to mm-hmm. me and it would resonate. And it didn't. And I learned about it through obviously some of those books, like those very, you know, high level books that I had lying around. There are probably Simpsons references to it. Definitely Ned Flanders.
Helpful.
Very helpful. You know, so that's kind of where it begins and ends for me. I think that the morality is so simplistic.
Yeah.
The way I view it through this story, especially, you know, when you describe it like you just did, which was great, it seems so simple.
Uh-huh.
But that is not what real life is.
No.
It's not black and white. It's every shade of gray.
Right. And something that's always bugged me about the Judeo-Christian God is he's omnipotent and he can do no wrong. Everything is part of his plan, be it when he's an asshole, when he's good, when he fucks up. It's all part of his plan and he can do no wrong. And it was only in university when I was taking courses in Greek mythology. Mm. The Greek gods, man, they fuck up all the time. They're like people with strengths and weaknesses and character flaws and merits, and they fuck around and they fuck up, and sometimes they mea culpa and sometimes they don't. But we can learn so much more from them fucking up, you know? Mm. So when we hear this story about God favoring Abel over Cain, like, that's on you, God. What the fuck is Cain supposed to do? Stuff like that kind of rankles me. But I felt like the way this film borrowed from it in meaningful ways. Like I said, I hadn't hit on that it was God as the poet from the beginning. But once I did, the crystal being the forbidden fruit, I missed that one the first time I saw it.
Oh, really?
It made more sense the second time around.
Yeah. And I think for this film, it brought to life a lot of the issues you and I have just talked about, because we're seeing the mythology, and certainly in my mind, in Mother, through the eyes of Mother. Mm. She's the outsider. She's not God. She is not bought into God fully. She loves God, but mm-hmm. she's constantly like, what the fuck? What the hell is going on? Why? Like, and she doesn't always act on it, but you can tell she's worried. She's concerned. She's angry. She's pissed off about it. Uh-huh. So I felt like it was almost an outside commentary on that mythology.
Right. No, I loved how at one point she calls him out. It's like, you just love how much I love you. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really poignant, just for the reasons I just said, how God is, you know, he's supposed to be this all-loving thing, but all signs point to a fairly narcissistic God who just, you're saved as long as you worship me.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to believe that that's some kind of love for humanity.
And that it's a promise.
Yeah. It ain't. It's a problem. I know a lot of people had problems with this movie. I can't see Christians getting up in arms over that interpretation being especially quarrelsome per se.
No?
No, I don't. I feel like most of the objections I heard around this film was that it doesn't make sense, that the allegory is too on the nose, that it's, I don't know, actually, I should have dug deeper into the objections. What are the ones that you're aware of? Like, why did the big cinema score F that was so damning to this film?
I think it upset people. I think it made them very uncomfortable.
On a religious basis or just like?
I think just in general.
Seeing the chaos.
I think the chaos, the violence, the ripping apart of an infant's body doesn't always sit well with a lot of people. And I think a lot of that I would actually attribute to Jennifer Lawrence, quite frankly. Mm. And I really like Jennifer Lawrence.
This is not
a hate on Jennifer Lawrence.
No, she's no bullshit. As far as Hollywood starlets go, she's cool.
I really like her, and I think she's great in this role, and I'm so happy she played this, because I think her strength, and what I've seen her do a lot of, especially in something like The Hunger Games, is she plays normal very well. She does normal very interestingly, and she has a lot of strength mm-hmm. to her. And I just find her very watchable. I like her. Mm-hmm. And she's a huge star. She's a huge star. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you've got, you know, your kind of top billed thing that, like, you sell a movie on is Jennifer Lawrence mm-hmm. and not much else, and a mainstream film audience walks in and they see a fucked up midnight movie art house byway construction site.
Sure.
They go, what the fuck was this?
Yeah, yeah.
I hate this.
Especially at the end to see America's sweetheart like stomped in the face in very graphic fashion. I didn't find this film especially graphic because I'm a horror guy, but to mainstream audiences and even art house audiences, I imagine it was a shock.
And I think that's it. I find this film very interesting for the way it utilizes its celebrity.
Yeah, some big names in here, man. Even like, even some a little more under the radar, like, what's her name? You love her.
Oh, Kristen Wiig.
Kristen Wiig has a fairly small role, mm-hmm. and it's always nice to see her in anything. Again, I'm a big fan, but it was just kind of like, oh, you, and that's your role? That's it? Bye. Yeah.
Ed Harris, Michelle Pfeiffer,
Ed Harris
Javier
and Michelle.
Bardem.
Yep, they're amazing. And even What's-His-Nuts from Pontypool.
Oh, Stephen McGaddy.
Wonderful.
And Domhnall Gleeson.
I don't know who that is.
He was Cain and or Abel.
Oh, okay.
But essentially, it's Jennifer Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so you got a prestige of Oscar, and you can say from the Oscar-nominated director. And people will go see that. And in the research I was doing, Aronofsky talks about, you know, he wrote this screenplay in a fever dream.
Yes.
And people are like, how did you make this fucking movie? And he was like, well, we did it for not a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And Jennifer Lawrence agreed to do it. And then Javier Bardem and Ed Harris and blah, blah, blah. So they could sell it through on star power.
Right.
But I think it's a little bit of a bait and switch when you have that. And I'm not angry at that.
No, fuck no.
I think we need that. Mm-hmm. And again, that's another reason why I really like Jennifer Lawrence, because she took a risk and made
yes.
a very strange movie.
Now, Aronofsky himself, for his part, is very critical of religion.
Mm-hmm.
He's a staunch environmentalist, which again informs many themes in this film.
And I think what this film is essentially a blend between the Christian Judeo history that a lot of the Western world has bought into,
mm-hmm.
I'd say for better or for worse, but it's often for worse, and the environmental toll that we as humans take on this planet. Mm-hmm. And it's about that tension between them. So again, I find it interesting that you've got him and this narrative that all unfolds from him and his actions. That is basically, as we've said, the Judeo-Christian history and mythology. And then you have this character who we are so invested in because she is the lead, circling around it and just going, why? Please stop. Please stop. Please stop. I like that tension. And one of the things that really interests me about this movie, and I thought about it like a lot after I first saw it, because I was like, yeah, okay, this Judeo-Christian, yeah, she's Mother Earth and it's about the environment. Okay, yeah, I get that, but it stayed with me. Mm. And usually stuff that's just kind of a quick one-for-one metaphor, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I kept going back to this quote. I may have mentioned this in another episode that I have taped up above my desk, and it's a quote from Roger Ebert, which is essentially, films are not what they are about. They are about how they're about them.
Wow.
So I actually...
the smarter things he said. We're usually ripping on him in this show.
And yeah, and I like thinking about that because that's something that when I get stuck, when I need to think about a movie, write about a movie, talk about a movie, I can go back to that. Mm-hmm. And it centers my thinking a little bit more. And what I think attracts me to this film so much is that you can say, well, I'm making a movie about Judeo-Christian mythology and the horrific impact of global warming. Mm-hmm. And you could do it in a million different ways, mm-hmm. if that's what the central idea is. But the way Aronofsky has framed this, a couple, the vast age difference, fixing up a house, and it's centering around this young woman. And the guy's a poet, and she's seemingly just staying at home and fixing up this house. Like, all of those things triggered a lot of ideas in me. And that's kind of what I've broken out here and want to talk about.
So another thing I'll say about Aronofsky in this film is he's not too coy about it.
No.
He's very transparent that he was in close contact with Paramount. They were really on board with what he wanted to do about teasing out this film, about not revealing too much in the trailer, because really, how could you? Yeah. But in the Reddit AMA that I saw and all the interviews that I've read, he's like, yeah, this is what this is. And I was influenced by these things. And so I took note of those things for the purposes of discussion. So one that came up was Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper, which is a short story from 1892 on postpartum depression and madness as the result of an overbearing husband. Now, yes, I said that right, 1892. Were you about to correct me?
Like, no.
Remember you did that to me once.
I studied that in several classes in my undergrad.
Oh, okay. No
yeah.
kidding.
Yeah, yeah. I can absolutely see that in this movie. I think I even read something that it's like, it harkens back to the yellow wallpaper because she has yellow walls in the movie. But I think what is important about the yellow wallpaper and the time it came out in, kind of towards the end of the Victorian era, and I studied it, I believe it towards the end of a year-long Victorian lit class I was taking for the first time that I tackled this book. But what was important about it is, to me anyway, what I found so interesting is that the gender dynamics in Victorian literature are super fucked up. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's about, you know, women, they're mad. And maybe they make a great heroine, but they're also super fucked up and they should probably be in a mental institution.
That's right.
The one that the yellow wallpaper probably gets the most associated with is the novel Jane Eyre.
Right.
And Jane Eyre is this very, like, frankly, uptight heroine of her own story, and I just find her very boring. Mm. And she falls in love with this horrible man, and this horrible man, Mr. Rochester, is keeping this, like, mysterious secret. And oh, what could the secret be? Oh, shit. He locked up his first wife in the attic because she was crazy, quote unquote.
Dirty little secret.
Yeah, you know, just like what you do.
Yeah.
So yeah, so it's kind of talked about in kind of reversal of that patriarchal norm of like, these women were mad, so we just kept them away. Mm-hmm, and like, mm-hmm. what actually happens to these women? And it's an incredibly important text, and it's actually quite short. It's basically like a novella.
Yeah, I think it's pretty easily. I'm sure we'll be able to link it in our course notes. But one thing that I was just able to find off Wikipedia, bless my heart, I didn't dig that deep. But it seems like Gilman herself, her story is pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. She wanted to write in an era where women were not encouraged to do so. Her depression was a thing, and so she was encouraged to have as much brain rest as humanly possible, and was only allowed to use her brain a couple of hours a day. So this is. The fact that she was able to come out with this very feminist short story on postpartum depression is kind of a big deal. And I do hear this text come up again and again when people are discussing mother and the yellow tincture that mm-hmm. mother not only drinks when she's feeling a little bit jittery. So there's definitely a narcotic implication there. The fact that she flushes it when she realizes she's pregnant definitely implies that it's a narcotic. But she also does mix it with her plaster to put on the walls. Mm-hmm. So there's that, I guess. Next up is a movie, a 1962 surrealist film by Louis Buñuel called Exterminating Angel. Are you familiar with this?
Not before I researched Mother.
I want to see it so bad. It sounds bonkers. It's about a dinner party where the guests are unable to leave and wind up starving, panicking, and hostile, ready to sacrifice someone if it means they can get out. And back to our friend Ebert, he likened it to its cultural context of the Spanish Civil War, where the victors sat down to a feast but found themselves too cut off from the rest of the world to enjoy themselves, which I think is really interesting. It also kind of reminds me of, I mean, any horror film where you've got people holed up and panic, like most specifically perhaps The Mist. Mm-hmm. And the final influence that I saw cited was a children's book by the name of The Giving Tree from 1964 by Shel Silverstein. Have you read this?
Yeah.
Really?
You haven't?
No, I'd never heard of it before this. It sounds
How did you learn
awful.
Empathy or kindness?
Is that what that book is about? Because
kind of.
The notes that I have are more
they're
about
horrifically depressing.
Abuse and exploitation.
Yeah, I had a lot of Shel Silverstein in my childhood bedroom.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you're not aware, this book is about a boy in a relationship with a tree who just... What's so funny?
They're like friends.
Are they friends?
I thought so.
Okay. Well, you know, I haven't read the book. I've only read...
Do you think this kid fucks the tree?
I don't think he fucks the tree. I think he rips it dry and it lets him. And in the end, it's...
Oh, so he's just in a relationship with the tree.
That's right. That's what I said. That is exactly what I said. It's about a boy in a relationship with a tree who gives selflessly, even as the boy starts to visit more seldom. And when the tree is little more than a stump, the boy visits her once again as an elderly man. And the tree is sad that she can't provide him anything, but he just wants a quiet place to sit, so she's happy to provide him that. Again, I haven't read it, but everything I've read about it is so intensely problematic and fucking sad. So please tell me how this didn't fuck you up as a kid.
I don't know. I really like horror movies. It maybe did fuck me up. One of the other influences I've heard Aronofsky mention is a book by Susan Griffiths called Woman in Nature, The Roaring Inside Her. And this is, I read a little bit of it today online, so I'll link it in the show notes. But it's very odd. It's very odd. It's one of those like 70s feminist texts, and it's like a little bit of like beat poetry and a little bit of like feminist scholarship and a little bit of some other stuff. And I don't know. She was talking about horse grooming for a while. And I think horse grooming was a metaphor for something, but I couldn't figure out what.
Wow.
But again, it was one of those things. I read up about it a bit. Some people really love it, think it's a really seminal feminist text. Some people really hate it. But Aronofsky cited it. So that kind of led me down a path to thinking about ecofeminism, which was a term I'd heard used. And the more I investigated it for this episode, the more it became really important to my understanding of the film, and especially because of the conflation of Mother the character and Mother Nature.
Ecofeminism, I'd only heard of it in the context of this is what feminism is, and here are offshoots of feminism. And I remember Marxist feminism was among them, ecofeminism. But I understand these things to like make use of metaphors and make use of different things that are oppressed in society and how they can be used to fruitfully discuss the oppression of women.
I have to say, as I was researching this concept of ecofeminism, this is something that came about in the 70s, and it was established by a French feminist by the name of Françoise Dalbon. Which, can you get more French than that?
Dalbon.
Obviously a very intelligent woman. She came up with this theory, and what's kind of impressed me the more I thought about it was ecofeminism actually has a lot of tenets of third-wave feminism in it and brings in a lot of intersectionality, understanding how feminism can touch a lot of different forms of oppression and how it should be indebted to that and how it should be a lot more progressive than just for women, but establishing a way of thinking and a way of life that is beneficial to everyone. And essentially, you know, ecofeminism sees the similarities between the oppression of women and minorities and the destruction of the environment by a patriarchal society. That human or potentially man's need to control the environment is similar to man's need to control women, class, structure, race, all of those things. Mm-hmm. That all of these things, including nature, including the environment, are in service to this kind of white, heterosexual, male agenda that we know you have.
Yeah.
You're just not telling us about it. But we know. We know.
I can see shades of that in life all the time now, like just kind of a return to midwifery, a return to like just even the reevaluation of the witch as a wise old woman who had her herbs and potions and stuff. This is an ecofeminist notion, and it's one that's being increasingly embraced, I'm happy to say.
Yeah, and I think the difference is between maybe some of the ways we're thinking about the environment right now and what ecofeminists you know, believe in the tenets of it is that in the stuff I was reading, they just kind of refer to it as a kind of contemporary liberal feminism, which is fighting for change and equality within the patriarchal structure.
That's right.
Ecofeminism sees a way to basically destroy culture and society as we know it, not in like a terrorist way, really, but just in a like, in order for everyone to succeed and be equal and for the environment to be healthy and us all to flourish, we need to do away with the system we currently live in.
That's right. We need to rethink things from the ground
exactly.
up.
Exactly. So in a lot of ways, it is quite radical, but none of the readings I did or the research I did showcased anything violent or
no, not at all.
Angry. It was like we are living this way until we can pull the plug on this.
Right. If anything, I was kind of leery about it because I was like, well, if you're equating women to nature, like that's a problematic patriarchal thing. But the ecofeminist readings that I was able to pull up were just like, that was ascribed to us. We're not doing it. That's just something else that's being oppressed. And I was like, oh.
Yeah.
So we'll link to some of that stuff in the course notes.
And I think, you know, it's just kind of bringing it back to the film. I mean, just the notion of mother being a one-for-one metaphor with Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this on the podcast before and the fact that women are seen as being more indebted to the earth and we can commune with nature and, you know, Sarah McLachlan. The biggest problematic element for me is that it serves as a separation between men and women. Mm. That men are somehow not responsible or connected to the environment, that they don't have a willing stake in it, that it's like we must be the caretakers and the nurturers and the garden havers. But it's everyone. Everyone has to take part in it. And I think what Mother does is it's just the terrifying reality. It shows the reality that the horrific elements of when that all falls to one person to take care of the house, the environment, whatever, you know, you want to subscribe to, but it's just her. Mm-hmm. And when no one else helps, it falls apart so quickly.
Well, yeah. And this is something that we talked about in last episode about the feminine domain, the domestic domain, the domestic sphere. He often says to her throughout this film, it's just a house. It's just a house. Who cares? It's just a space. You know, people matter more and ideas matter more. And that's a very privileged position. When she's doing all the work in the house, she's the one who has to play Sally hostess when she has guests, which fine. Like, I really didn't take an issue with watching this film. The one thing that did kind of muddy my waters when thinking about this house as nature is that, you know, the house is fundamentally private property. People barging in unannounced, it's not quite the same thing as people inhabiting the earth.
Yeah, I think it's just the notion that humanity in general is just kind of, as we currently exist and have existed in history, has just been a plague on the planet.
Just taking and taking, taking and taking.
Taking and taking and industrializing and doing things to harm it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the research I have read on the environment that I kind of do in my, you know, spare time when I'm trying to relax is that every year we get like closer to the doomsday clock hitting midnight to a point where we will just we will die.
That's right.
And the children will die, and everyone else will die, and everything, it'll just be so irreversible. Mm-hmm. And it is so fucking scary. Mm-hmm. It is so fucking scary that there's a lot of it I actually can't read. But some of the research I have read was essentially saying that us on an individual level, if we recycle all our things, if we compost everything, if we do all this stuff, that actually won't make the difference we need. The difference we need is in government. We need lawmakers and politicians who are not in the pockets of oil companies and industrialists and all of that nonsense. People who will really care about mm-hmm. the environment and maybe buy into the Paris Accord and stop when we can. Mm-hmm. And that will make the biggest difference for future generations and make this planet a sustainable place. But right now, it's not looking so good.
I'm not holding my breath.
You might have to in a couple years. One of the things this film really keyed in for me was the role of him, or God. And he's a poet. He's a writer. He constantly talks about needing to write. Man shows up. He's a big fan. All of that stuff. And it just became, obviously, I think very apparent if you watch this movie, that he is a writer. He is an author of some kind. And one of the theories I studied when I was doing literature, English literature, was the theorist Roland Barthes. And he's a literary critic, a theorist. And he wrote this piece that was originally published in 1967 called Death of the Author.
I feel like I know him. Did he write on archetypes? I feel like we talked about him... Cabin in the Woods episode.
Yeah, I feel like we've talked about him before. He's an interesting guy. He's got some good ideas, some bad ones. I think this is one of his more interesting ideas. And basically, Barthes' whole thing in this piece is that he wanted literary criticism to move away from the worship of the author. That Vladimir Nabokov wrote Lolita, so let's dissect who Nabokov is. Let's see how this story relates to his life, and we can build out a history and a criticism based on that. Mm. It's subscribing a lot of power to one person because they are the author, they are the creator, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And Barthes actually felt that was incredibly wrong, that the weight was completely off. So in this piece, Death of the Author, Barthes believes that any text in the whole wide world is made up of previously existing ideas and sayings. It is not an author, the individual, but rather a quote-unquote scripter who is arranging previous texts and ideas into something maybe new or maybe something that's just slightly different.
Huh. I'm with that. That sounds like what we do. Like, we're always saying, you know, fuck the auteur. And, like, we're talking about Aronofsky's background here. I think it's relevant. I think it's interesting to add to the discussion. But fundamentally, it's about the text, right?
And the problem with the kind of auteur theory, to call it that, for the sake of this episode and this podcast, is that the single person is not truly able to create or decide the meaning of his or her work. The meaning is in the power of the reader or the audience. It is the audience. This is, again, something we always talk about, audience reception. That's something we're both really interested in. And that culture, our culture historically, has preferred what is called heroic discovery, which attributes an idea to one person. One person found this idea, and therefore he is the most brilliant person in this idea ever. Mm. And we are all kind of subservient to this idea. You know, the kind of like the cult of personality, the cult of Bill Gates or Steve Jobs or someone like that.
Right.
Now, what Barthes describes as the idea of the author is essentially God, someone who is constantly working to maintain and create power around his work. And whereas Barthes would describe the scripter as someone who is born simultaneously within the text. Does that remind you of any two characters that we might be talking about?
Wait, hang on. There's a scripter.
So the scripter is someone who assembles ideas and tries to attempt to make new ideas or new meanings, but essentially it's just a curator.
Okay.
Essentially. Uh-huh. But they are born of the text.
Okay.
They're discovering the text as it goes along. Uh-huh. Whereas the quote unquote author, concept, perception, what have you, is a godlike figure who is maintaining their power and maintaining the importance of their work.
Okay.
So I think these are two really interesting ideas that are working in tandem with each other, because essentially God has a kind of, in this film, let's say him, has a kind of false power. Mm. He has the power of influence. He has the power of creation to a certain extent, whereas the scripter or mother is born with each iteration of the story and is constantly discovering things, but is the one who can end it all and is seemingly has ended it repeatedly.
Yeah. It's true. She keeps pulling the plug and is doomed to repeat
it. Yeah. In slightly different versions of herself. And ultimately what Barthes says in this piece is to, quote, "The birth of the reader must be at the cost of the death of the author." Hmm. And I think that's something that Aronofsky really speaks to quite a bit, is that he himself does not want to lord over this piece. Mm-hmm. He wants to talk about it, to educate people and get people scared and get them active. But he wants, you know, the birth of the idea that they should be concerned about these things, about this world, to come from the audience. He is simply creating a vehicle through a lot of, as we've already talked about, influences, extremely obvious metaphors to really scare us. And he's talked about in interviews kind of this notion of global warming, of religion, and taking it from this big macro level to the micro, literally situating these problems within a house with a kind of family structure that looks vaguely familiar, and especially with familiar faces in terms of the actors. And I think that this attack on the traditional literary criticism that places the importance on the audience essentially places the importance on us as viewers of this film to create action, to create change, to make sure that this time Mother doesn't blow us all up.
Wow.
And I was listening to, I sent you the link today. I don't like this in the show notes because it's kind of a funny interview.
Super funny.
It's pretty funny. But it's from the Directors Guild podcast, the Directors Guild of America. And it's after a screening of Mother, and Darren Aronofsky is interviewed by William Friedkin, director of The Exorcist.
Yep.
And, as much as The Exorcist is a, I think, kind of a timeless film, Billy Friedkin got old and like a fucking curmudgeon. He's so cranky.
So let me get this straight, you young whippersnapper.
Do you believe in God? Answer the question.
He's intense, but I've got to, I mean, for a filmmaker like Aronofsky, kept him on his toes. He was, it makes for a great interview.
It's a really interesting interview. It's about half an hour, so if you have time, I definitely recommend checking it out. And so in the interview, Friedkin is like really on Aronofsky, but like, they're burning coal over here. What are we going to do about it? We can't do anything. And Aronofsky is like, you can vote. You can vote. You can, you know, make change and make progress through this. And I think we have to have articles that lay out how close we are to extinction, all the horrible things going on in this world. But as we talked about in a lot of our episodes, art serves a purpose. And I think if this film affects you and you look into it a bit and you think, yeah, okay, this is about the environment. This is about the way that Judeo-Christian mythology has, frankly, controlled a lot of our culture. What can I do differently? Mm. And it places the onus on you, the individual, to affect change. So I think a text like this is actually quite important. It certainly was upsetting and strange and weird, but I liked it and I responded to a lot of it. And I think without overtly saying, you know, like, it's not like Aronofsky comes on at the end of the film like, "So, Jennifer Lawrence dumped me, but I think you should go out and vote." Like, it's a subtle thing. It's implied. But, you know, you can take action. And I think that's really important. And I think, dare I say, noble?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's as far as horror filmmaking goes, holy fuck, it's as noble an endeavor as ever. I have to confess that I didn't come away with it rethinking my views, my already really fatalistic views on the environment.
I don't think it's meant to make you rethink that. No. I don't think this is the film that's going to be like, hey, you know what? I think climate change is bad. Coming into this movie, I thought it was super cool. But it, again, it's taking it from that macro level, that big, high level, 10,000 feet view of it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm looking at this world and it's on fire, but I'm not feeling the effects of it
right
now.
That's exactly
this is
it.
Now I'm watching it in a house.
It crystallizes it.
Yes.
It crystallizes it into a narrative that is way more accessible than this macro level, unpenetrable sphere of politicians and what can I do? Mm-hmm. I can place a vote. You know how many times I've voted for candidates that, like, don't even get me started. Do you know who our fucking premier is right now?
Ugh, you guys can Google it. It's fucking depressing.
Yeah, and you know what? Don't.
So one of the things that resonated with me right off the bat when I first watched this film was, again, this notion of placing God as a writer and a writer who could not work unless he was inspired, and him kind of talking to Mother as, you inspire me.
Yeah.
And so obviously that triggered in me the idea of the muse and what does that mean and the kind of strange gender dynamics that are at play when we talk about muse, especially in service of a male creator, whether it's a male painter, writer, musician, what have you. There is a kind of long lineage of women helping men create things, often at the sake of them creating something of their own. So when you look at the muse, it actually traces back to Greek mythology. And initially, muses were inspirational goddesses of literature, science, and art. They were considered a source of knowledge.
Yeah.
They were the carriers of knowledge. And throughout culture, especially, you know, into the 19th and 20th century, the notion of the muse became parallel to women being objectified and then artified by men with no true agency of their own.
Right.
I think into the 21st century, we can kind of look at this phenomenon as something like the manic pixie dream girl.
Okay.
This quirky, young, female woman who is in total service of a male character who is downtrodden, who has been somehow made to feel less than by society. And through her love or her attention, he finally finds the power to create or pass on to the next level of his life.
Right.
And I think there is something, again, that it is inherently problematic. And what I like about the film Mother is that it serves as a critique of that. We see how isolated Mother is. We feel that frustration. She is happy when he writes. She is happy when he creates, but all he creates is chaos. And the second he becomes popular and famous and the nightmare really starts in the film, okay, that's when all hell starts to break loose. And she's constantly being pulled into, like, photo opportunities as the house is falling down around them. And I like that it feels very critical of this role that women are played and the marginalized role that they are forced to play. Mother becomes literal arm candy as war is breaking out around her.
Well, yeah, when it happens, it's because, you know, they have a fight and she throws out, well, you won't even fuck me. Well, in the midst of all this chaos, they do fuck, and miraculously she becomes pregnant right away. And what does he do? He takes off to be alone and to turn it into his art. And she's kind of like, oh, well, okay, you know, I thought we could have a nice night to discuss what it is we've created together, but you've taken it and made it your own, which was a very musey thing to do. And brutal.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a muse in Dogma?
Mm.
There's angels and then there's muses.
Yeah, Salma Hayek. She's a stripper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's just kind of, she's really nonchalant about it. Yeah, I'm a muse. I'm not quite this, I'm not quite that, but I inspire people and I can influence people. And it's just kind of a, I don't know, it almost feels like that scrap of bread that's tossed.
And I think the difference between inspiration and influence is actually quite huge. Influence implies, to me, agency.
Mm.
I'm getting you to do what I want you to do.
Right.
Inspiration is, like, if I inspired you to do something right now, Andrea, it would feel kind of separate from me because it's you going off and doing something.
Right. And it was you doing your own thing that would therefore inspire. Exactly. And I think that's a major criticism that I did see among feminist scholars about this film is that, you know, Mother just kind of, she's kind of does her own thing and she reacts to him, and all she's really concerned about is the house.
I think it's more of a criticism. I think by pointing out what that dynamic is in the relationship, it becomes more of an examination of what that relationship is rather than a, like, check mark, this is a good thing. It's like, no, there's a huge power imbalance. There's something really wrong in this relationship, like really wrong.
Yeah.
And again, I kind of alluded to it earlier, but I find it very interesting that in this, throughout the production of this film, And again, no one wants to talk about authorship or Darren Aronofsky having authorship over this film, but that he and Jennifer Lawrence started dating. And they dated for, I think, a bit during production or towards the end of production through the post-production and then for a little bit after the film was released.
It was after principal photography because I looked at that.
But yeah, I think, you know, if you got something like when we talk about the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, you see that in something like Garden State in Elizabethtown. And that's where it becomes really problematic for me because it's depicted as being a good thing that you should want to inspire this young, quirky man who's played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt to want to do something because of your bangs. But it's but here it's shown as inherently problematic. And again, I think to critique Mother's role in this, that's kind of problematic in and of itself. Again, like we're talking in our episodes, you know, throughout the whole time we've been doing this, that, you know, there isn't a wrong way really to be a woman.
No.
You can care for your house. You can tend to your children. You can say fuck all of that and do something entirely different. And I think it's mainly about the power and the balance between the relationships that we have where, you know, you see the biggest truths. And I think this really illuminated for me that power has to be balanced within a couple. And when it's not, all hell breaks loose.
Right. I think the film also did a great job of navigating these waters in that it's not that she's putting a coat of paint. It's not that she's baking cupcakes. These aren't like the traditional domestic roles. She is restoring the house. It is a very grand, old-fashioned house, and she's making it work again. She is concerned with the water main and how the counter is not yet braced. Like, these are technical attributes to the construction of the home. This isn't surface-level Martha Stewart good housekeeping.
But props to Martha Stewart. She does have some really good ideas.
Sure.
And I also think it's interesting that every incarnation of Mother destroys the house.
Yes.
The house that forever, how long she exists, she has been rebuilding. And then she destroys it, and then it comes back again. She's stuck in this cycle because him ultimately has the most power in the relationship, and he can control it, and she is kind of doomed to this cyclical, horrifying life.
Oh, yeah. And his attitude toward it, just be like, oh, here we go again. Better luck next time, honey. You gave it a good go. It's crushing. Mm-hmm. And yet you can't hate him, can you?
Can't you?
I did not.
Well, it helps that Javier Bardem is very charming and very handsome. So that does help. But yeah, I kind of hated him. And one of the last things I wanted to bring into the conversation about this film was the notion of dream or nightmare logic.
Yes.
Because this film, I think for me, this is the most that feels like an incarnation of my nightmare.
100%.
It's
do you have a reoccurring nightmare?
I used to.
What is it?
I used to. It was something. It stems from a very specific point in my life. And it's essentially someone who I used to be very close with on the other side of a door trying to break it down and get to me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shining-esque.
Yeah, very. And in this apartment that I used to know in Montreal, it's very thing, but everything is always off.
Yeah.
Everything's not quite real.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason I feel so strongly about this with Mother is just I think it has this intuitive dream logic to it. And to define dream logic, which I did have to do because I feel like we all know what it is, but it's basically, through all the research I did over the last week, it's that we take these elements of our dreams. And a lot of researchers tend to believe that they come from things that are in our minds, situations, traumas, happiness, whatever that is. And this is how our mind processes them when we hit REM sleep.
Mm.
And so dream logic is applying logic to things which are essentially nonsensical.
Mm.
Oh, I dreamed of my aunt last night. That must mean I have unresolved X, Y, and Z.
Mm.
That kind of idea.
Okay.
Now, what I find actually very personal about Mother is the first time I was watching it, I was like, oh, God, this is like a fucking nightmare. Wait, I know that person. No, I know that person. And because I realized at the end of the film it was actually shot in Montreal, a lot of the people I know from when I worked in theater are in this film.
Oh, my God.
So I was like, that's Eric. That's Trish.
It's your nightmare. Jesus.
So it's all of these people I actually knew. So it feels like, Andrea, I just had this dream, and like Jennifer Lawrence was married to Javier Bardem, and she was trying to fix this house. And then Eric, who is my friend's neighbor and who I worked with on a play, and Trish, who I went to theater school with, was in it. And that's so weird.
Yeah. And I'd be like, that sounds like a dream.
Yep. And just so everyone believes me, I did reach out to my friend Trish Somerset and asked her. She plays the woman who first sits on the sink.
Oh, what? Jennifer, that fucking bitch.
Yeah. And Jennifer Lawrence is like, it's not braced. And she's like, what? Whatever.
She just laughs her off.
She laughs her off.
Wrung her fucking neck.
I know. I saw it in our first year acting class together.
That's wild.
So I reached out to her and I was like, what was working on this set like? And she was like, because again, it's a relatively small part, but she said the script was incredibly limited access. I assume she only got a page or two of her stuff that was on it. And they did so many takes.
Okay.
So many takes, which is actually impressive because of the visceral feeling of this part, especially as it kind of delves into this final half or final third. So I think what's important when we talk about dreams and why we associate power and importance to dreams is because so many cultures across the world, across history, have associated dreams as a means of connecting with the sacred of a different reality or of a different dimension. Mm-hmm. There is a belief and an idea that when we go into our dreams, when we are able to pull out memories from them, we are bringing back something from another world, again, another reality that will help us in our current world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's actually very fitting for this film.
Yeah.
That we are experiencing this kind of strange nightmare that informs and begs us to take action.
Right. I have a recurring stress dream that's in my early 20s. I was a waitress at this fucking mom and pop cafe restaurant style place. And I'm sure there have been more stressful incidents in my life since then. I'm sure since then I've defended my master's thesis. I moved to Toronto. I had this job. I got fired from it. I competed at high level roller derby, this and that. But whenever I'm stressed out, I'm back at that bar and things are chaos. And I turn around and something's on fire. And I turn around and there's my old friend. And I turn around and there's my mom and she's sick. And I turn around and that's what the film really felt like. The way it escalated mm-hmm. with nonsense, but also you know exactly what's happening. And
yeah.
It was so well done. It was so well done that you rolled with it so willingly.
And I think it's interesting that the film, as we talk about it, it's so much of a metaphor. Mm. But by the end of the film, it is so literal in terms of the people and the world and the things that are being created within it. You know, there's French protesters, there's flags being burned, there are all of these things that it's like watching BBC World News.
Right.
And I think it's really interesting that we move from a very metaphorical realm into what I believe to be a very literal realm.
Mm-hmm.
The film kind of goes from macro to micro back to a macro level,
mm-hmm.
which I think is very interesting. And certainly for me, it works. It pulls it off.
Yeah.
But I think even if it didn't work for you, I'm glad someone fucking tried to do it.
Well, I hear people discussing this film in two parts, and mm-hmm. I can see why.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why that would happen is, you know, the first act maybe is this really biblical allegory before the second act is just bonkers. Still allegory, but it just goes off to the nth degree, and it's not maybe so much narrative anymore, but I was never bored and I was never lost. I was always completely engaged, which, God bless, holy shit, not easy to do.
No, and I think, and Aronofsky himself gives a lot of credit to Jennifer Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
And just in terms of the shooting style, there are basically three main shots they use throughout the film. So they shot either over her shoulder,
mm-hmm.
they focused the camera on her in a medium shot so you could see her face, or it was her point of view shot.
Mm.
Basically, every film, you'll have those shots, but you'll also have a lot of establishing shots that you can always cut back to. And Aronofsky in the interviews we'll link below in the show notes, he says there are maybe three or four of those.
Mm.
Which rewatching the film, I actually believe. But so much of it is her.
Mm-hmm.
And as he, again, gives her credit, like, if she hadn't been on, if she hadn't been working, if she hadn't been really good in this part,
mm-hmm.
the film wouldn't have worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was also interesting that there is no score in this film.
What?
There's no score in this film.
Wow.
There are creaks, like,
not.
The house makes noise.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, in one of these
the
interviews.
Din. There's always a din.
But, like, even in, like, the noises the house makes, Aronofsky, in one of these interviews, talks about how that's actually pulled from Jennifer Lawrence's own voice or grunts or things like that.
Mm.
So the house feels like it's deeply indebted to her.
Hmm.
And he even talks about working with a composer, and they compose really beautiful music
yes.
that they placed on the film And it just didn't work.
Right.
And Aronofsky talks, actually, again, it's an IndieWire podcast interview we'll link, about how he actually felt like, ooh, there's like, when we put it on, there was an authorial intent.
Right.
And that felt wrong.
Yeah.
It didn't feel right. So right. We have this beautiful score that maybe we'll get used some other time, but it just didn't work for this film.
That was Johan Johansson,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yep.
And he even gives Johan credit that, like, they agreed that not to use the
yes.
score, and that in and of itself was a musical score decision.
Mm-hmm.
He did the soundtrack for Mandy, mm-hmm. which everybody's freaking the fuck out about.
We aren't.
I didn't quite resonate with it, but we'll talk about that next episode.
Really?
Anyway, from what I understand, he passed just after that film came out.
Right.
So that's too bad.
But hopefully we get to hear this score because Aronofsky speaks very highly of it at some point. But yeah, I mean, that's a lot of my thoughts about Mother is it has this ephemeral quality to it, but it also has this grounded quality to it. It's upsetting. It's inspirational. It gives me a lot of feelings, but also some very clear takeaways, which feels a bit like an oxymoron, but not angry at it.
My takeaways were so raw and really uncomfortable. This film sat with me in a very uncomfortable way immediately following seeing it. At first blush, I mentioned before that the mother nature metaphor hit me, as did the Christ-like narrative of the baby. Those landed, but they're not what made me love the film. What made me love the film was the depiction of some emotions and scenarios that I often experience, and I consider them to be inscrutable. And this was something that came up when we were doing last episode, and you were talking about Betty Friedan and the thing that has no name.
Mm-hmm.
So much has no name, and sometimes that can be captured in a moment and in a feeling, and that happened to me with Mother many times. And the first corresponds to the first half of the film, which was that feeling of being trampled, that feeling of being invaded. And I'm a very open person, I'm a very inviting person, and I think that comes from a combination of being Italian and being raised with, like, you know, hospitality first, but also having been shut out from stuff that I was passionate about at a young age because I was a woman, and not wanting to do that to anyone else ever. And so that's something, I'm an open door, always have been, and I'm like that with my work. I'm like that with Faculty of Horror, I'm like that with Rue Morgue. I'm very extroverted and interested in people, and sometimes that entails making myself very vulnerable to being overrun. So that was a thing. But when it came to the second half of the movie, when Mother has accepted that she's lost her husband completely to his fame and his following, I found myself thinking about my career and my commitment to work, and I felt this pit open up in my stomach because I finally realized what it must be like for my partner to be with me. And I'm not going to say that I lost Jennifer Lawrence in that moment, but I identified with him.
Mm.
And for him to always be second fiddle to my fans, to have to contend with my tapping on my phone all day, the fact that in the evenings when we're quote-unquote free to watch movies, I need to watch something for the magazine or I need to watch something for the podcast. I often dictate what it is that we watch based on my ulterior motives. And I signed up for all these sacrifices and he didn't. I was aghast to see myself represented in the husband figure for the second half of the film, blithely ignorant of the harm I might be doing to the most important person in my life. It was yucky, man. I felt like shit after that. And it was a difficult thing to confront because here I am in my late 30s, like hurtling past my prime caregiver years that I've chosen for various reasons to devote to my career. And obviously there's an element of wondering whether or not it'll pay off. I'm certainly not getting rich off it, but for many years it paid off in satisfaction. It paid off in people telling me that my work has inspired them or entertained them or just mattered to them on some level. And I've had to ask myself what that means for my intentions. You know, like, am I in this for applause? I've been called a narcissist. Is that what I'm in this for? Maybe in the end that's somewhat true.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to feel like a narcissist as a woman because we are taught and we are generally raised to feel like that's bad.
Well, to be the giving tree.
Yeah.
And to get anything in return, even if it's a little bit of applause, would make you feel guilty and make you feel like him.
Mm-hmm. I think my feeling on that, and I definitely understand that feeling, and thank you for sharing it. I was in a relationship very similar to Mother's in my early 20s, hence that reoccurring nightmare I talk about. And he was a writer. And he was all about himself. And he was all about that fame and that glory and whatever it would get him, whatever microscopic thing it would get him, that was more important. Mm-hmm. And once I got out of that relationship, I decided I was never going to dim my light for anyone. And I dimmed my light for him. And I feel really, really thankful, not lucky. Mm. I feel thankful for the career I have because I've been told by multiple people that I don't deserve this career, that I got it from someone or something outside of myself. Mm-hmm. And I've decided that I'm not going to entertain that idea because I know the nights, the weekends, the days, I've given up to it. And I've loved most 80% of the minutes mm-hmm. of it. And I feel very fortunate that I have a partner who supports that and who knew what he was getting into and has his own dreams and his own ambitions. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to support them. Mm-hmm. And I want more than anything for him to succeed. So there's a lot of feelings about that dynamic.
Yeah.
That we both have.
It's, you don't want to be the giving tree and you don't want to be the taking boy.
Yeah. But I think that's something that we wrestle with a lot. And you and I have talked about this a lot. And for so long, through so many different ways, big ways, little ways, I was made to feel like I couldn't have the things I wanted. And once I decided that I really wanted those things and I went after those things and I got some of them, I developed some of the deepest friendships in my life. I found a partner who loves me for exactly who I am. And that's what excites me. And that's why I know I want to be with him for the rest of my life. Because I'm not pretending to be something I'm not.
I have no qualms with my career. I've never been more certain about anything as my devotion to my career. I guess the film just kind of made me consider that the sacrifices that I make, sometimes I'm making on behalf of others. And I think, you know, for women who are perhaps socialized to be so giving and giving and giving and not say anything, I think we're really lucky to have partners who mm-hmm. support us the way they do and who we dragged along to Salem to, you know, sit in our limelight. I drag Dustin out to events, and as soon as we get there, it's like, see ya. I got to host this show, and you got to sink or swim. Anyway.
But I will say, to end maybe on a positive note about this idea, that when we were doing the live show in Salem, and we quote-unquote dragged them, and they were in the audience.
Kicking and screaming, pried the Xbox controller out of his hand.
But they were watching with smiles on their face and I think a lot of pride and a lot of excitement.
Absolutely.
And that was a really special thing for me. And yeah.
Absolutely. I don't think anyone should be ashamed for what they want and for what they have.
And I think that's a good thing to know about yourself and for everyone to check in on. Mm-hmm. How am I doing? How is my partner doing? Because I think this film illustrates that we will only survive by doing it together. Whether it's as a couple, as friends, as society, as humanity, if we don't take care of each other, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And it's currently not working very well mm-hmm. in the macro sense. So I encourage everyone to, in this holiday season, check in on people.
That's right.
Say hi. See what you can do. Make a little bit of effort and see if you can help someone have a better day.
And if you love our show, by all means, clap your hands for us, but recognize that there's people behind the scenes supporting us, and we owe them some thanks. So let's give them maybe an official shout out on the Faculty of Horror podcast to our partners and our friends who've helped us out with this over the years.
And our pets.
6 years.
6 years.
My asshole dog has been trying to interrupt us this entire episode.
If I didn't hear that squeaky noise just now, I would have cried. But yeah, this December, it's our anniversary, so this has been 6 years of Faculty of Horror.
Yeah.
We started at one place, now we're here in so many senses. Mm-hmm. So many things have changed, and I think most of them for the better. So it's been a really exciting ride.
Yeah.
I can't wait for another year.
Yes.
More great content.
That's right. So next episode, we're going to do our year in review. We're going to have the bloopers. We're going to do something fun. We haven't quite decided what yet. If you have any ideas, we could do the newlywed game again. We can do Q&As. We can do...
Do you want to hear from our partners?
Skits.
Like?
We can do voices. I can do my Gene Wilder impersonation.
You sound like...
Yeah, that wasn't a good one.
No, you sound like someone... That was like a Bill Cosby impression.
Oh, no. Do you know I have one of his vinyls in my collection?
Burn it after?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
It said just for adults. And I was like, oh, fuck, man.
No.
Anyway. To that end, to wrap up this episode, I think I just kind of want to say that, you know, we talked about how this old creation myth didn't really have a parable. It didn't really have a teaching. It didn't really have a philosophy or anything you can take away from it. I really think that this film gave it that. And have a lot to take away from it. And we've just discussed it.
So let us know what you take away from this film. I think as much as it's a one big metaphor, you can reach in and find something really personal and then turn it into a crystal and reboot your partner with it. But let us know what you think. I think this is, as much as it's a big film, it's also a personal film. Mm-hmm. So let us know what you pull out of it. If you want to comment on one of our social posts on Twitter or Facebook, go for it. If you want to email us, if it's more private and you just want to share it with us, that's cool too. Even if we don't totally respond to every email, we do read them. That's info@facultyofhorror.com. Also, again, as Andrea mentioned for the next episode, if you do have any questions for us, we do take it as an opportunity to do some frequently asked questions and respond to those. So if you got any of those, hit us up with those.
And until 2019.
Oh my God. Office hours are closed.
Exemplar.